welcome to the Digital Sue podcast. I'm Samantha Davis, and I severely underestimated just how much work this last semester of my associate's degree would be for me. And I can already predict that October's episode is going to be late as well. October 1st is when applications open for a school I'm applying to for transfer. And this is Editing Sam coming in with something really quick that I just learned. It is the 30th that I am recording this aside, but still. October 1st is the start of FAFSA for American students. So if you're an American student listening to this, please file your FAFSA as soon as possible, because they're adding $150 billion to the FAFSA pool of money, and a lot of schools do first come, first serve. So get on that, kids. But it's going to be a cool episode next month. Hopefully this will get out during the month of September. For the rest of the year, that's kind of just my goal, is to get the episode out at some point during the month. Please bear with me. I am having a crisis. So I do know that December's and New Year's episodes are going to be out on time, because I won't be in school for much longer in December, and the end of December I will be on break for a while, so I'll definitely have enough time. And, you know, it's just, I am really good at stretching myself thin by procrastinating and, like, sitting for a minute, because I have to let my brain rest for a little bit, but I just keep adding time to that by, you know, scrolling through my phone and looking for ideas for new episodes while I haven't recorded this episode. I mean, it already just took me so much energy to just sit down and record today. I am garbage. Not really. I am just, I'm very busy. I am currently putting off laundry and math homework for this, so you better appreciate this episode, okay? I don't know when it's going to get edited, because I have to do math homework first, but here we are. I'm holding you captive this month on your commute or during your housework or whatever you do when I talk to you about Buffalo, but we're not actually going to be talking that much about Buffalo. Now, we have a charity of the month, and I added another one that we have spoken about before, just in lieu of current events in America with the blatant infringement on human rights in Texas. So please send your money or your time to Planned Parenthood and write your congressman. But the original charity of this month was going to be Defenders of Wildlife. This month's charity is an organization that is fighting for much more than just American bison. They're helping conservation efforts for wolves, dolphins, condors, bighorn sheep, elephants, bears, and even more. There's just a million different animals they're fighting for on there. There are even efforts to rehabilitate and protect environments like the Great Plains and the rainforest. They also advertise that 97% of funds donated go towards the program and support services, while the rest go to fundraising, so just 3%. Not only can you just donate to a variety through a variety of avenues on their website, you can also adopt an animal for yourself or someone else, and there are even multiple job opportunities available. It's like paid and unpaid internships, so check it out if you're into animal conservation. Now, we have quite a few sources for this episode about the American buffalo. So obviously, I went to my trusty pal Wikipedia on the American bison. I also used LWOS Life, Lessons from History, PBS, and Powwow Times. I will try to remember to link all these in the show notes if it gives me enough room to do that. But if you are interested in reading more about this animal after this episode, reach out to me through the email that we're going to talk about at the end of the podcast episode. Firstly, we have to talk about the fact that the Americas don't actually have any buffalo. The term American buffalo is a bit of a misnomer. It has nothing in common with the Asian water buffalo and the African buffalo. Scientists believe that an ancestor to the buffalo and the bison crossed the Bering Strait land bridge to evolve and populate in the North American continent, but that's kind of the extent of the relation. There's not too much that they have in common today. The American buffalo is actually the American bison, and it has been on the North American continent since the early Holocene in 9000 BCE, or about 11.7 thousand years ago. Just for reference, the first Homo sapiens evolved 315 thousand years ago in Africa. The American bison mainly resides in a large area of land in North America called the Great Bison Belt. It's a rich grassland that runs from Alaska all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. And you can actually see a lot of these bison outside of this stretch of land. There's been sightings in New York, Georgia, Florida. Oh, I wrote Georgia twice. So there's probably a lot of extra sightings in Georgia if I did that. There's even a place called Buffalo Ford in North Carolina at the Catawba River that had been used according to record by the buffalo, that had been used according to written record as late as 1750 by the buffalo. This is Editing Sam back again. I'm sure you guys totally understand what I was trying to say, but just in case, no, I'm not suggesting that bison have a written history. They don't have thumbs. How would they do that? What I am saying is the white colonists of this area have a written history that far back. However, the indigenous people of the area have a very long oral history of bison living in this area. Seeing as the American continents have such a wide-ranging ecological climate, it doesn't really surprise that there are two subspecies of bison: the plains bison and the woods bison, and the wood bison. The American bison itself can weigh up to 2,400 pounds and stand at about 6 feet tall. They can also sprint up to 35 miles an hour, usually when a human gets too close to their young or their territory. Their large heads and broad shoulders are evolutionarily made for pushing aside snow, usually to find food, but they can also be used to rock your shit if you try them. They're kind of the epitome of the fuck around find out animal. So is a lot of wildlife, but just a good rule of thumb, if you're out in the wilderness, it's a fucking fuck around and find out animal, you know? Leave it alone. And bison fur is actually so thick and insulating, snow can fall on them and not melt. There's a lot of very cute pictures of bison with little snow hats on. It's very cute. The plains bison has been further subdivided into the northern and southern varieties of bison, while the wood bison is the larger animal with a taller, more square-shaped hump behind its head. The wood bison is known as the second largest wild species of still-living bovine animal in the entire world. And I think you can guess where each subspecies of bison that I just mentioned resides, so I don't think we need to get into where north and south is. I trust you guys. Now, the only animal taller than the American bison in North America is the moose, who is also a fuck around and find out animal. Did you know that the moose has a natural predator of the orca? Moose will semi-regularly dive very deeply down into like kelp forests and stuff for food, but they don't do it often enough to develop any sort of defense against the orca, and the orca know that the moose loves to, that moose love to go down there. So it's regular hunting grounds in certain areas of America for moose from orcas. It's kind of crazy. I've seen pictures. It's insane. I will, however, say that I've also seen pictures of moose that are swimming. It's adorable. I've also seen moose when they come out and there's all this like algae and stuff stuck to their antlers. Also, adorable. Highly recommend, guys. Now, going back to the bison, well, you wouldn't necessarily think it. Bison aren't necessarily known for having huge horns, like longhorns and moose and stuff. They do have horns, and they have to rub their horns against trees, like deer and moose and other antlered animals, in the fall and winter months just to remove all the... God, I'm totally blanking on the word. I regret not writing that down, but it's this sort of fuzz that grows on antlers that they have to rub off in the winter. All right, after a 10-second Google search that I definitely could have done while recording, here's Editing Sam. It is just, it's called velvet, and the process is just called shedding their velvet. If you Google it, Just be prepared that a lot of the pictures of deer shedding their velvet look like a horror show, because it's bloody on the antlers once they rub off the velvet, and it doesn't just rub off like peach fuzz, it peels off. So there's like blood all over their heads, and it looks like their skin has been peeled from the antlers, you know? It's not a great picture. Like, I definitely can't post this. I can't post any pictures of this on Instagram. You're gonna get some cute pictures of bison, and that's it. I'm sorry. I will get my account destroyed by Instagram for posting pictures of that. Google at your own risk. Now, what's really interesting about what bison do is they prefer to rub their horns on aromatic trees like cedars and pine. And some research believe that this is a natural insect deterrent for the animal, which is really cool. I wish I had thought of that because I get eaten alive every summer when the bugs come out. Now that we know what we're dealing with, we're going to get into how the bison were viewed by the tribes of the Great Plains region of North America. Anyone who's been to the Great Plains of North America can tell you, while it's no desert, there just isn't too much that's incredibly useful to develop a thriving community. There's not that many trees. There are some, but they're not as plentiful as, say, other areas. And this environment is why the bison was so important to the peoples native to the Great Plains region of North America. The native tribes of the Plains culture area became really reliant on the bison, using every last bit of the animal, from the horns to the tail hairs. This animal is so important to these people that it's even a part of religious ritual for them. Tribes are made up of thousands of people, so the amount of meat on a buffalo was preferred to hunting multiple deer. And the bones of the animal made really durable tools. The scapula, or the shoulder blade, made an excellent scraping tool for preparing hides, and I'm going to go into kind of a long list about all the ways they used the animal, but I highly, highly implore you to look at pictures of these because they're honestly very beautiful tools, especially what I just talked about, this bone scraper. Maybe I'm weird, but I think animal bones are usually very beautiful, and I love looking at how maybe an animal evolved from a common ancestor by comparing them. I think it's fascinating. But we'll have to get back to the list now, huh? So the bladder of the animal was usually cleaned and dried and used as a water bottle. The horns were also used as a water bottle and cleaned out for the purpose. Other organs like the brain and liver were ground into a pulp, and this softened the hide of the buffalo that could be then worked into leather, and the tendons were used to make sinew to sew the hides together into clothing. Even the hooves were boiled down to make a glue for tool making. Anything you can think of that was made of fabric, they found a way to make it out of buffalo hide. Clothing, blankets, moccasins, shelter. Now, the Plains culture area was the only culture in North America to use the teepee, even though it is kind of, by racists, attributed to all Native Americans. And I think it has something to do with sort of the cowboy movies of the 40s and 50s. I guess 60s. Well, we have cowboy movies now. The cowboy movie genre, the Native Americans they come in contact with are always the people in teepees. And I get that. Most cowboy movies do kind of take place in the Midwest, in the Wild West, so it makes sense that they're there. But for an audience who has no other knowledge of Native people, they think everyone's like that, and it's ridiculous, frankly. Like, read a book. Well, getting off my high horse, these hides were also able to be treated to become totally watertight, and they were able to keep wearers warm. And really, this animal was the ultimate way to provide for your people. The teeth were turned into jewelry, and the buffalo itself is a symbol of strength and unity to the First Nations and Native American peoples. The skull of the animal is used in a lot of very important ceremonies like the sun dance and in sweat lodges. It's also known as one of the four sacred animals that are the spiritual protectors of this world. Their unique hunting practice for buffalo is, or bison, was also really interesting. The Great Plains culture area, a lot of the people there are known as specialized hunter-gatherers. So we know what hunter-gatherers are. says so in the name. When you have to become a specialized hunter-gatherer society, it usually relates to the environment. Like, if you're in a somewhat desert of the plains, and the Inuit people, they are in a desert. So they had to have a very specialized way of hunting. And it's very difficult to hunt a bison. Like I said, they can fuck up your shit if they want to. But they are still a wild animal and capable of being spooked, and the native people knew how to use this. A series of hunters would spook herds of bison into a frenzy, and they would lead them into falling off a cliff, and a whole herd would go off the cliff. Here, they would fall and die, and the hunters could then process the bodies and feed their people for months and months at a time.
And while we know that this practice happened because these people are still alive, what's really cool is archaeologically, in these areas that have been inhabited by people from the Plains culture area, archaeologists have been able to unearth these things that have been termed buffalo graveyards. And it's these layers upon layers of buffalo skeleton that wasn't used. And you don't find like whole skeletons usually, unless it was an accidental death and no one was there to process the body in time. That's like a whole story. But if you go directly under a cliff, you're very likely to find some buffalo remains. It's very fascinating. I have tried to Google search some images for you guys, but I keep getting graveyards for people in Buffalo, New York. And I don't know how to not do that because I have tried a bunch of different search terms. So, you know, just use your imagination, guys.
But the colonizers had a different approach. Blech. So we're going to get into the U.S. government's war on buffalo, which is what it's called, even though it's bison. I know, just stick with me here. So unfortunately, this symbiotic relationship some of the native people had with the bison did not go unnoticed by the U.S. government. The so-called war on buffalo can be traced back to three main contributors: the U.S. Army, commercial overhunting from white colonizers, and railroad expansion. The U.S. Army's ultimate goal was to clear out the native population from the Fertile Plains region by any means necessary. By cutting off such an integral part of their culture, the nomadic hunter-gatherers were much easier to forcibly move to reservations of non-fertile land far out of the way. This is Trail of Tears style, which, by the way, it wasn't just one trail and it just didn't happen in one area. The Trail of Tears is just a time period, basically, where these people were completely brutalized by the colonizers. Some U.S. government officials actively destroyed bison to weaken Native American tribes that resisted colonization. The American military commanders ordered troops to kill buffalo at any opportunity to disrupt this really important food source for Native people, and they would leave the animals to rot. They wouldn't even use the meat, usually. And even buffalo hide is actually a well-known alternative to leather. It was more watertight and it was better suited to the environment. But these colonizers didn't care about that. They just cared about destroying this thing that was important to these people that were in their way. Once forced onto these reservations because of food scarcity, they were unfamiliar with the lands left to them, and usually the land left to them was shitty anyway and over-farmed to hell. And they became really reliant on the U.S. government for food rations and annuities. Staying sedentary in the reservations was also really disruptive to their lives, as they were a very nomadic people, and they by definition did not really want to stay in the same place. Now, while the U.S. government did sign treaties about hunting grounds with some tribes, they were almost never honored. The U.S. government couldn't use the army to kill enough bison, so they contracted commercial hunters as well. By the middle of the 19th century, even train passengers were just shooting bison for sport as they passed by, leaving them to rot again. Buffalo Bill Cody, who's kind of a famous guy in America — I have a few non-American listeners, if you want to be really disgusted, go ahead and Google him, because he's not a great guy. He was hired to kill bison by the government and killed more than 4,000 in just 2 years. The animal later became a centerpiece of his famous Wild West show. What was most dangerous about this new policy from the government was that commercial hunting was almost always for sport, so the animal was overhunted, and largely the kill was wasted, like I've said. They would either just take the head and leave the rest to rot, or they wouldn't even take a trophy at all. However, indigenous people who hunted the same animal for food were severely punished, according to the signed treaties that were not being honored in the first place by the other side. And actually, a lot of Native people have laws against when you can hunt in such large quantities. If you think about it from their perspective, the most effective way to hunt bison is to drive a herd off a cliff. If you do that all the time, no more bison can be made, you know. And they realized this from fairly early on in like human development in the Americas. Like they were like, oh yeah, we should think about that and maybe not overhunt. They knew this all over the Americas, and then these colonizers come in and they're like, it's fine, guys, we can just kill them all and it'll be fine. This disrupted the ecology of the area because, like I said, bison were a huge part of the Americas. I'm going to get into the numbers of just how many we had in the Americas before colonization, but it was a lot, and killing that many, that can disrupt the entire ecosystem. So I'm not saying it caused the Dust Bowl, but I feel like it did, you know? The third blow to the population of bison was also sponsored by the U.S. government. The railway system was expanding rapidly, and bison kept getting on the tracks, damaging trains when they hit them. That's how big these fucking guys are. So railroad companies hired professional hunters to kill bison to feed their laborers and protect the investments with enthusiastic military support. Ugh. This is Editing Sam, and I finally came up with a good name for this groan that I've had multiple times through the episode. It's like the colonialism growl. You know what? Come up with a name for me. That would be great. Please email me a name for my exasperation. And with that, we're going to take our ad break. I'm really liking these mid-level ads because I can build suspense. We're going to see if the buffalo ever has a resurgence in the Americas. And while we wait, please actually do send me your suggestions for this groan. I don't like the name I came up with it now that I've said it out loud. We're not ending on a low note, guys. There's been a resurgence of the American buffalo, or bison. It's confusing for me too, you guys. I'm doing my best. I grew up in Texas where they make us learn where the buffalo roam and the deer and the antelope play. You know, that's why the title's what it is. I highly recommend you look up that song and not just listen to my bad rendition of it. I don't really know where to go from here. I've talked myself into a corner yet again. Let's go onwards. The resurgence of the American buffalo. In 1905, zoologist William Hornaday formed the American Bison Society to reform wild herds of the animal. Then President Theodore Roosevelt asked Congress to establish multiple wildlife preserves and was able to stock many of the preserves with the help of private bison owners, as an extant herd of bison in the area was only 20. This preserve was later known as Yellowstone National Park. Yeah. This park controlled the population until 1967, when the herd was 397. So after that year, they stopped the disease control of the herd and they stopped killing to take down the population. It peaked in the 1990s to more than 4,000 in the herd. There are currently between 150,000 and 200,000 bison in North America, with the majority ranch-raised and wild, which is why you can still get bison burgers in America. So that statistic is from PBS, the 150,000 to 200,000. I'm telling you guys this now because Wikipedia has something a little bit different. So they have this beautiful table, and I'll just start with, I don't want to read all of them, I'll give you sort of the highlights of it, but pre-1800, it's estimated that about 60 million bison were in North America. Not kidding, guys. Not kidding. That's how bad it was, because there was a pretty severe drop in 1870 where in 1840 it was 35,650,000 bison, and then it took a very steep drop into 1870 to 5,500,000. That's pretty crazy. And then just 10 years later in 1880, it was 395,000. They killed 5 million, and well, they killed 30 million in 1840, between 1840 and 1870. And it just keeps going down, and the lowest point being 1900, where it was about 300 total in the United States and 15,000 in Canada. Or, oh no, I'm sorry. 300 total in the US, and then in 1944 through 47, it surged in the US to 5,000, and then it surged to 15,000 in Canada. That's where it messed me up. In 1951, we got up to 23,000, and their estimate at 2,000 was 360,000, which is a pretty big contrast to PBS's estimation of just 10 years earlier with, or I don't have a date for the PBS number. Oh, geez. I think it was like a modern times of 150,000 to 200,000, which, so conflicting reports. I tried to find the best version, and here we are. Point is, they're not as endangered as they were. They're still in danger, but they're not endangered. Yeah, they're not totally safe yet, but we're on the right track, if that makes sense. And on that very hopeful note, it is time to wrap the show up. So for the book of the month, I've lately been reading From Here to Eternity by Caitlin Doherty. This semester, I don't have any anthropology classes, so I have to get my death traditions and culture fixed somehow. Caitlin has a great YouTube channel where she has a series called Ask a Mortician. And here she talks about death in a very positive way and how it can be treated in the present versus how it was treated in the past. Her episode on the true story behind the book Moby Dick is one of my favorites. I now know that there is a set period of time for when it is okay, it is actually advantageous to cannibalize people when you're shipwrecked. Because I don't know if you guys know this, and I bring this up at every dinner party, but once people starve to the point of depleting all their fat preserves completely, it's not okay to eat them anymore because your body won't be able to process it. The human body can't process food without some kind of fat. So if all the fat in your buddy has been depleted because he's starving, if you hit him on the head with like a coconut or you cut his head off with a machete or whatever, I'm going survivor terms here, if you kill this guy to eat him, odds are you're not going to survive still, which is crazy to me. I didn't even know. I did not know that, but well, now if I'm ever stranded, I can be the voice of reason. Hopefully we'll find a pig or something to eat first. Now, the author, Caitlin Doherty, narrates her book, and it's really interesting because it is sort of a memoir style where it's told through her point of view. She travels the world looking for the so-called good death, and it's really interesting to see how ancient traditions have been translated to modern times in some societies, and how ancient traditions have had a revitalization in modern society because they're no longer being oppressed by, like, a Christian state nearby, which is really interesting. And if you're curious about this book and I haven't convinced you yet, check out her YouTube channel. She talks about current events. She's done a lot of episodes on COVID and just what's happening with bodies. It was very sad, but very interesting. She also talks about folklore and old ways that death has been handled in different cultures. Overall, it's been super informative and really enjoyable, just like all of her content. And I'm really excited to read her more kids, teens book that she produced called, like, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? And it's all the questions people have about death. And it looks really fun. Now, the tool of the month is a little weird, but with school starting up again, I have been very, very busy, but not too busy, to make a Nutella tiramisu recipe from Munchies. I will link it in the bio because it was super easy and delicious. This I saw on Claire Saffitz's YouTube show Dessert People, And instead of making it in individual jars like they do in the video, I put it in my square glass Pyrex pan. Lasted less than a week. Highly recommend. My tool is the glass Pyrex. Well, that's it for this month. I hope you guys liked this episode. I really enjoyed researching it. I'm really glad I finally have the time to sit down and record it. Hopefully edit it in the following days. Email me at digitalsue@gmail.com with questions, comments, and suggestions for future episodes. Find pictures from this episode on the official Instagram at digitalsue. For both of these, it's all lowercase, digitalsous, no spaces, all lowercase. Check out more of me talking on the Opening the Vault podcast. I'm rewatching and reviewing Disney movies chronologically through a modern lens with a couple of co-hosts. Well, actually, I think we've lost one of our co-hosts, which has been really sad and scary. He's kind of ghosted us. So, John, if you're out there, I really hope you are okay. And please text us back or email us back. Ben says hi, too. But for the next couple episodes, it's just going to be me and Ben. We might find a third person. Thank you for listening. Make sure to tune in next month. It's going to be kind of a silly, fun one. And that's the show.